This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, November 29, 2004, at WBAI in New York. I'm Deepa Fernandez. U.S. attacks and violence from the Iraqi resistance continues to take lives in Iraq. We get the latest from Baghdad. The Supreme Court hears arguments on the use of medical marijuana. And in Colorado, today marks 140 years since the Sand Creek Massacre killed more than 150 Native Americans. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to review the Massachusetts state law allowing same-sex marriage without comment. The Massachusetts Supreme Court voted by a narrow margin to mandate such marriages late last year. Since May of this year, more than 3,000 gay and lesbian couples have married in Massachusetts. At that time, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to interfere with the issuance of marriage licenses. Next year, Massachusetts voters may have the opportunity to decide whether the state will offer civil unions instead of marriage to same-sex couples. In Ohio, more people are organizing objections to the U.S. presidential elections. Evan Davis has more from Columbus.
Attorneys preparing to contest Ohio's election cited evidence of what may be vote rigging in 13 southern Ohio counties. Attorney Cliff Arnebeck explained that in a close election for a state office in Ohio, the Democratic candidate received a margin of votes which was higher than the margin for John Kerry. That's evidence, says Arnebeck, that the votes in the presidential race may have been transferred during the tabulation from John Kerry to George Bush.
All this civil rights violation was a red herring and intended to stimulate the public interest groups and civil rights organizations to hone in on this horrendous attack on the rights of white black voters. They thought that's what we would go after. The clock would run out. We wouldn't be able to prove our case. The real fraud occurred in this switching of votes in southern Ohio. That's our present view of the evidence.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
Mass demonstrations in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev continued today, where the fairness of the presidential elections last week is still in question. Today, the outgoing president pleaded for a new poll in front of the nation's Supreme Court, set to decide the election in a few weeks. U.S. and European election observers declared the results fraudulent. David Kotz, professor at the University of Massachusetts, specializing in the economics of the former Soviet Union, said that the U.S. role in the Ukrainian elections is hypocritical at best.
For the American government to say, we will not accept the results of this election by implicitly stating that if the Ukraine Supreme Court rules that the election should stand, the United States is saying that's illegitimate. It's hard to see how that could be considered anything but hypocritical, in my view.
U.S. officials have supported pro-Western candidate Viktor Yushchenko, who lost by the official count. Current Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych, heavily supported by the Russian leadership, was declared the winner last week. Professor Kotz said there was election fraud on both sides. Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers leaders say they have reached the limit with government officials over the stalled peace process. Poniya Manikavasagam reports from Vavuniya.
Sri Lankan Tamil Tiger leader Velupilla Prabhakaran Saturday cautioned the government that his organization would be compelled to launch the freedom struggle if peace talks were further delayed. In an urgent appeal, the renegade leader called upon the government to resume the stalled peace talks over a radio annual statement marking the rebels' Heroes Day. There was no immediate response from the government. Sri Lankan President Chandrika Kumaratunga has rejected the Tamil Tigers' self-rule proposal unveiled over a year ago as a stepping stone for a separate state. A ceasefire is enforced between the government and the rebels. Norwegian brokered peace talks are stalled for the last 18 months. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Peace activists gathered in front of a federal building in Chicago this morning, protesting the use of U.S. tax dollars to fund ongoing war and violence around the globe. Johnny Happ of WZRD reports.
All in this world is our sisters and brothers, and God, I pray that
the 20-plus protesters prayed in unison before sitting down in front of the east entrance to the John C. Kilchinski Federal Building. Protesters are calling on the U.S. government to stop funding war. Kathy Kelly is founder of Voices in the Wilderness and spokesperson for today's Action of Civil Disobedience.
You can decide not to any longer turn over your productivity, your income, to the United States government when half of it is being directed toward war and war making.
The protesters remained seated in front of the entrance over an hour, singing songs and reading aloud a litany of resistance. They believe the assumed re-election of President Bush means that it's more crucial than ever to be vigilant about protesting the enormous budget of the Pentagon. From WZRD Chicago, this is Johnny Happ for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights will tomorrow file war crimes charges against Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, former CIA Chief George Tenet, and eight others stemming from the Abu Ghraib torture. The case will be filed in Germany at the Federal Prosecutor's Office. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld today rejected calls from some members of Congress to increase the number of troops stationed in Iraq. And as FSRN correspondents Dar Jamil and Salam Talib report, while the U.S. is claiming the ends of its actions in Fallujah justify the destroyed city, violence continues throughout the country.
Violence continues unabated throughout Iraq. Today, another car bomb detonated in a fiery explosion at a police checkpoint near Ramadi, claiming the lives of at least seven Iraqi security personnel and injuring nine others. A huge roadside bomb in Baghdad killed two more American soldiers, while wounding at least three others. Another soldier died, and two others were wounded near the city of Kut in what the military called a, quote, vehicle accident. Over the weekend, at least five soldiers were killed in the Al-Anbar province of Iraq, which includes Fallujah. Two other Marines were killed south of Baghdad in the Babil province on Sunday, but the military would not elaborate as to how they died. With at least 10 soldiers dead in Iraq in the last 4 days alone, the siege of Fallujah appears to have only spread fighting throughout much of the country. Last night, Iraqi resistance fighters stormed a police station near Samarra. Facing no opposition, they commandeered several police cars and looted the armory of the station before departing unscathed. Faisal al-Rabai, a relief worker assisting Fallujah refugees in the small city of Amariya, discuss shockingly heavy-handed tactics used by the U.S. military against the refugees in his area.
What has happened in Amira is just like what happened in Fallujah. This is because 3,500 refugee families are living here. They are sleeping on the ground because there is nowhere for them to live. The siege of the city was done to stop the help for these people. Sheikh Shukut was detained for the second time now because he was distributing supplies for the refugees. The Americans don't want to detain him only, they are targeting the refugees. They also raided the hospital there today and destroyed everything in it. They attacked the Islamic Brotherhood NGO and burned and destroyed the supplies they had for the refugees.
The elections scheduled for January 30th continue to increase instability across the country. While calls from Kurdish and Sunni political parties to delay the elections have been ignored, Shiite leader Muqtada al-Sadr has called for a boycott of the elections. While Iraq's highest religious authority, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, is encouraging his followers to vote, al-Sadr refuses to participate because he feels the elections are illegal since Iraq is occupied and under martial law. One of Sadr's aides added that the boycott is due to crimes perpetrated by American forces against Iraqis in Fallujah. So far, at least 47 Sunni, Shiite, Turkmen, and Christian bodies have declared their boycott of the upcoming election. In Bakuba, Sheikh Adnan expressed an opinion held by millions of Iraqis.
The elections will be like a building, like a wall that will be built, whether I want it or not. But as an Iraqi, I refuse to be a brick in this corrupt wall.
Meanwhile, in Basra today, British and Iraqi troops were deployed around the headquarters of the Iraqi National Guard after the Chief of Staff, Brigadier General Dia al-Khatami, refused to accept an order from Baghdad to remove himself from his post. The standoff was continuing Monday night. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dar Jamail with Salam Talib in Baghdad, Iraq.
Today, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments as to whether the federal government may prosecute and raid the homes of people who use medical marijuana in the 10 states that allow such usage. Mitch Jeserich reports from the Supreme Court.
Outside of the Supreme Court this morning, sign-carrying demonstrators, both for and against the use of medical marijuana, argued amongst each other over its use.
And they knew marijuana. They tried it and finally tried it.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you know, it's not making me black out like alcohol does.
Nope. Because people like to get high. That's why it's going on 60 years, and there's a lot of money behind it.
Inside the court, lawyers were arguing the merit and legality of medical marijuana as well. The case, filed by two women from California, where medical marijuana is legal, is seeking a permanent injunction against federal officials to prevent house raids and prosecutions of people who grow their own marijuana, prescribed by doctors, for their own medical use. The Supreme Court had previously ruled that medical marijuana cannot be sold, but it also let stand a Ninth Circuit court ruling allowing doctors to discuss it with their patients. Today's case looks at whether people can grow it for their own use. In August of 2002, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency raided the home of one of the plaintiffs, Diane Monson, in Oroville, California, seizing six marijuana plants. Monson uses the drug for chronic back pain.
The federal government seized the plants and took them over the protests of the sheriffs, the local government. They tried to protect me, my sheriffs. They tried to explain that this is my only medicine. I do not take any other medicine. I was prescribed Vioxx. Thank God I quit Vioxx. I feel very confident that this is the best medicine for me.
The other plaintiff is Angel Raich of Oakland, California. The DEA raided the homes of two caregivers who, for free, were growing a year's supply of marijuana for her. Angel Raich has an inoperable brain tumor, a seizure disorder, and nausea.
If it wasn't for cannabis, I really would not be here today talking to you. Today, if they decide that I have the right to live, then I will be able to spend the rest of my life with my family. On the other hand, if they side against me, it means that they would be giving me a death sentence. And I can hear to tell you today that no matter what the justices do, I unfortunately cannot stop using cannabis because if I do, I would die.
The question to the court is whether the Interstate Commerce Clause gave the federal government the authority to go after medical marijuana in states that allow its use. The federal government argues that it does, saying that legal marijuana in some states will inevitably drive down the street price of the drug nationally, making it easier to buy and thus making it an interstate matter. But several of the justices responded with skeptical questions as to how could people growing marijuana purely for their own use affect cross-state commerce. Randy Barnett argued the case for the plaintiffs.
If you took the argument that any effect on the interstate market is enough to allow Congress to regulate, which is a position that's argued by the government, if you take that view, then really the federal government has power over everything.
But justices also asked critical questions of Barnett as to whether medicine by a state referendum, such as California's 1996 law, was better than medicine by strict regulation and approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
If a state can, through a ballot, can make something a medicine and make it available, we are undermining the protections that are built in to a regulatory scheme that was developed in 1906.
Dr. Robert DuPont is a former White House drug czar and is the current president of the Institute of Behavior and Health.
The treatment is 2,000 chemicals put together in an unstable, unpredictable way and smoked, which is a toxic drug delivery system. The Institute of Medicine made clear that if there are any of these chemicals that are useful, they can be synthesized or purified and delivered for specific indications.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich in Washington.
Today, more than a dozen immigrant workers arrested on misdemeanor loitering charges are in court in Northern Virginia. And as Darby Hickey reports, their case is at the center of a growing national movement against police harassment and the arrests of immigrant day laborers.
13 immigrant day laborers are in court today in Manassas, Virginia. They are among several dozen workers who have been arrested in the past months in Northern Virginia for loitering, as police use new powers to enforce immigration laws, granted to them this summer under a new Virginia law. Police are mandated to arrest individuals suspected of immigration violations and allowed to transfer any person without identification to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Branch of the Department of Homeland Security. More than a dozen of those arrested have been transferred to immigration detention for deportation. The law, HB 570, is the first of its kind in the U.S., and people across the country are mobilizing against it. Ricardo Juarez is a construction worker who is organizing his fellow laborers in the area.
We've demanded that they stop the arrests of immigrant workers immediately. We've demanded the end of the use of unconstitutional charges like loitering and other false excuses of the police to arrest and deport immigrants.
The workers in Woodbridge, Virginia, are being supported by local community members and groups with similar concerns across the country. They are calling for a national movement against repression of day laborers, and so far they have support from groups like the Farm Laborers Organizing Committee of Ohio and North Carolina, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers of Florida, and the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE. Rizwan Maulana of CARE spoke at a rally recently.
How can a police officer determine that this person is an immigrant? Only by profiling you can do that. You're not going to stop somebody, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed person, and find out whether he is legal in this country. This country is built with the sweat and toil of the immigrants, and it will be decided by the sweat and toil of the immigrants.
For many of the day laborers, the increase in political activity has been a lesson in activism and organizing.
Escuchen. Primero, ¿qué queremos? Respeto. Pero todos a una sola voz. Cuando vuelva a decir...
Lessons in politics, English, and basic legal rights take place on roadsides and in parking lots where workers gather.
¿Qué queremos? Respeto. ¿Cuándo? Ahora.
Much of the support for the workers in Woodbridge is coming from other organizations of immigrant day laborers and workers around the country, where similar incidents have happened. In Freehold, New Jersey, the Day Laborers and Immigrants Support Committee won a federal lawsuit against the city to stop police use of loitering charges to harass workers. That tactic worked in Orange and Passaic, New Jersey as well, says Mahonry Hidalgo, who is part of the fight.
No más, nunca más en la sombra.
No more, never again will we be in the shadow, will we be hidden. Never again will we be afraid. Never again will our rights be violated. Never again will we be arrested for working with dignity. And most importantly, never again will we allow the perpetuation of this absurd immigration system that destroys lives and separates us from our families.
In Redondo Beach in Glendale, California, day laborers have sued local governments as well. Laws in those cities, like about 50 others, prohibit public solicitation of work. Members of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, which is a party to the lawsuits, say police in those jurisdictions use entrapment tactics, with plainclothes officers driving to day laborer sites and arresting any workers who approach their vehicles to ask for jobs. With support from the local American Civil Liberties Union, workers in Virginia say they hope to file a lawsuit against local and state authorities to strike down loitering arrests, which they say are unconstitutional. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey of the DC Radio Co-op.
Today is the 140th anniversary of the Sand Creek Massacre, which saw more than 150 Native Americans slaughtered by federal troops at Sand Creek, Colorado. Under the command of Colonel John Chivington, the troops attacked a peaceful encampment of mostly elders, women, and children. The descendants of those killed at Sand Creek held a memorial service this weekend in Colorado. Maeve Conran reports.
A letter from Lieutenant Joe Kramer, a witness to the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864, was read at a memorial on Saturday on the steps of the Capitol in Denver.
Women and children were scalped, fingers cut off to get the rings on them, and this is much with officers as men, and one of those officers a major. Little children shot while begging for their lives. Women shot while on their knees and with their arms around soldiers a begging for their lives, and all the indignity shown their bodies that ever was heard of.
Saturday's memorial was the last in a series of events which saw a group from the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Montana take part in a three-day spiritual healing run from the site of the massacre in southeastern Colorado to Denver.
The reason why we do that run is to honor, commemorate the bloody trail from the Sand Creek Massacre site.
Steve Brady Sr. of the Northern Cheyenne Sand Creek office explained how the group are also trying to repatriate the human remains which were taken by the federal troops as trophies after the massacre.
The theme of this year's Sand Creek, 6th Annual Sand Creek Spiritual Healing Run is the liberation of our elders. And that is in direct reference to our ancestors who are held in museums here in downtown Denver and University of Nebraska at Lincoln and Sam Noble Museum. We are in the process of liberating our ancestors from bondage, 140 years of bondage after being butchered at Sand Creek by federal troops.
Despite federal legislation passed in 2000, which will see the site of the massacre preserved as a national historic site, the federal government have not done enough to remedy what happened to the Native Americans.
The United States promised reparations through Article 6 of the 1865 Cheyenne-Arapaho Treaty. It remains unfulfilled today. At some point in time here, down the road, the United States will be held accountable for its unfulfilled obligation that has legal, moral, and historic implications.
The memorial service ended with the Cheyenne Victory Dance. For Free Speech Radio News in Denver, Colorado, this is Maeve Conran.
Colorado is also one of the top states in the nation for the loss of farmland. This week, the state will lose yet another 20 acres of farm as Naropa University, a Buddhist-inspired institution in Boulder, sells the land to developers. FSRN's Courtney Smith brings us to the farm and the community around it.
The Kitchen Restaurant in downtown Boulder relies on Hedgerow for fresh, locally grown produce. Restaurant part owner Kimball Musk feels the sale of the farm does not fit with Naropa University's community-minded image.
What makes it especially sad is that Naropa has a reputation as being a different kind of university, one that has some sort of altruistic principles. And it's very sad to see that they're really no different to any other corporation in America, where profit is the bottom line, and community, unfortunately, isn't.
I'm just taking the basil leaves from the basil wood, Italian basil, and then you put it into the mortar and pestle and you grind it up.
Paul Cure at Hedgerow Farm in Boulder, Colorado, prepares basil to sell for the last time to local restaurants. Cure and his wife Anne work, live, and thrive at Hedgerow Farm.
On an average, farmers in Colorado are decreasing at exponential numbers anyway. Which is really unfortunate. Something like 90,000 farms are lost each year, you know, since the late 80s. That means there's over 2 million farms that have been lost. That's pretty alarming because that's our food source.
According to the American Farmland Trust, an average of over 1 million acres of farmland in the United States is lost annually to developers. Naropa University owns the 20-acre organic farm and employs Ann Cure to maintain the farm and the community programs for children and elderly. This week, the Cures are packing up and preparing to move out as Naropa University seals the deal for $1.5 million. The new buyers plan to demolish the 100-year-old barn, home, and farm to build a new house in its place. Naropa president Thomas Coburn denies financial struggles and says selling the farm is in the best interest of the university and its tuition-paying students.
This has been a very difficult decision for the board and for staff, not something that was done precipitously, that was done, I think, in a way that the Buddhist phrase, mindfully, would apply.
Cindy Torres was an intern at the farm and led community members to sign petitions and write emails begging Naropa to save Hedgerow Farm.
With the kind of philosophy that they build their reputation on, that they build their school on, and their curriculum, if anybody was going to go the extra mile and take the time to save the farm with their resources, that it would have been Naropa.
Torres hopes Hedgerow's story will gain widespread support for local farms around the nation.
There's not enough importance put on local agriculture, and unless you have community support all over the country, you know, it has to be a nationwide celebration of food and where it comes from and how it's grown. You know, there's not going to be a change.
For Free Speech Radio News in Boulder, Colorado, I'm Courtney Smith.
as so-called renovation projects throughout Los Angeles are moving in higher-income residents, long-term residents and their crucial cultural landmarks are being ignored. Musicians in and around Mariachi Plaza say they've been subject to a campaign of intimidation and abuse for the past several months and are holding 24-hour performances to bring attention to their plight, as Aura Bogado reports.
Hundreds of musicians are gathering all day and night in Mariachi Plaza in the Boyle Heights district of East LA. The plaza, created over 40 years ago, replaced an old donut shop where mariachi musicians would gather to play. The burgeoning LA Metro Gold Line has designated a future station at the plaza, but the rise in interest in the mostly Latino community has started to take its toll on residents who have made it their home. Elias Valdivia Zaragoza came to Mariachi Plaza 4 years ago. He typically plays in restaurants at weddings and parties until about 2 a.m. He lives in one of the apartment buildings across the street from the plaza. His building was recently purchased, and because of renovations, construction would regularly start at 6 a.m, allowing him only 4 hours of sleep on most nights.
Three times I went out there to tell them to stop all the noise. I want to get some rest. I don't have anything against them if they just want to fix the place up, but I'm against them making all that noise in those early hours. They never listened to us. They'd stop for a while, and then they'd go back to their noise.
Besides the noise, Valdivia Zaragoza says the construction has made his life a living hell. Hot water would be turned off for whole days, and for 4 months, all the residents in his building were forced to share one bathroom. The bars on his first-story window have been removed, although he was offered a newly renovated apartment in the building. However, Valdivia Zaragoza has been paying $480 a month, but the renovated apartment now goes for $950. He's struggling with the owners to keep his old apartment while dealing with the construction all around him. As a result of an attack by a construction worker, Valdivia Zaragoza has stopped complaining.
One week I was getting their attention, telling them not to make so much noise so that I could get some sleep for a week. That was Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday passed, and on Sunday I was coming home from work with my roommate, and they shot me with a nail gun. Look here. And my roommate, they shot at him too, and it hit his violin case.
He was shot with a nail gun in the chest and believes that it was done by a construction worker. Although he filed a police report, the perpetrator was never found. Other residents who live in the surrounding blocks are worried about what the new metro line will bring. For the past 100 years, musicians, their families, and supporters have turned the neighborhood into the West Coast's heart of mariachi music. Lily Hernandez has been a resident here for the past 50 years, working as a waitress and cook since she was 14. Since retiring, she spends her time sewing bows and ribbons for the players.
The mariachis always come here, and then from here they go to other places. They go to Texas, or they go north, but they always, well, the place they always start is here. And that's why we're asking for support. I mean, the entire community came together to create this place.
Elizabeth Blaney is an organizer with Unión de Vecinos, a group that works with residents in Boyle Heights. She says that what's happening at Mariachi Plaza is just another example of gentrification in L.A.
It's just an overall plan where a lot of the lower income and poor communities are having to pay the price for what redevelopers want their idea and their designs are for the city.
The mariachis say they will keep playing at the plaza as long as they can and will continue to oppose the removal of one of LA's oldest communities. Reporting from KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.